This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Sean Lay. In Georgia, they are saying goodbye. Goodbye to a former president of the United States. Goodbye to an occupant of the governor's mansion in Atlanta. Goodbye to the owner of a peanut farm in Archery. Goodbye to their friend from Plains, Jimmy, the boy who became the 39th head of state of the USA. As NewsHour comes on air, a private family service is underway for President Jimmy Carter, who died at the age of 100 last month. It's taking place at the Carter Centre, an organisation devoted to advancing and defending multi-party democracy, which Mr. Carter founded after leaving office during the longest post-presidency in history of any occupant of the Oval Office. Jimmy Carter was a Democrat, but official Georgia is represented this Saturday by a Republican, Governor Brian Kemp, there to greet the cortege on behalf of all Georgians. Just before 11 this morning local time, the hearse halted in Plains, the tiny town where he was born and died 100 years apart, where he was still taking Sunday school classes into his mid-90s. As the car waited, engine purring smoothly, a bell was rung 39 times for the man who was the 39th president of the United States of America. While the casket has just been carried into the Carter Center in Atlanta, let's pause and hear the choir as the family file into their seats for this private service.
On the sea, most Holy Spirit,
the state funeral spans 6 days, three cities, and multiple stops at places which held particular significance for the Navy veteran, peanut farmer, state governor, and president of the United States, who served in the White House from 1977 to 1981. It ends next Thursday at the Capitol Building in Washington, D.C. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a reporter who's at the Carter Center. But first, let's hear from the Carter family itself. NewsHour's Paul Henley has been speaking to Jason Carter, the former president's eldest grandson, who is also chair of trustees at the Carter Center.
You know, for me, the memories and the remarkable thing really is that he wasn't any different in private than he was in public. For us, that meant we'd sit around at the dinner table at Christmas time and we would talk about rare African diseases. You know, but we also just went fishing and went to baseball games and did the things that you do with your grandfather.
And you were close to him.
Yeah, it was wonderful. I mean, you know, I had this great opportunity to have him around for so long in my life. I mean, I'm 49 years old. My children are 18 and 16, and they both got to know their great-grandfather really well because of the gift of his longevity. And so I spent the last 20 years working with him at the Carter Center, you know, as part of my volunteer work and his life's work.
From early on, he gave you advice, didn't you? And you took it.
His mother turned 70 in the Peace Corps. And when he got out of the White House in his 50s, I think she was standing behind him saying, "I turned 70 in the Peace Corps. What are you going to do?" And so I think that was motivating to him. And when I was a young, you know, 21-year-old whippersnapper and said, what do you think I should do? He said, "You should go to Africa and live in a village in the Peace Corps." And I did it. And it was life changing for me.
How do you feel about a 6-day state funeral?
It's certainly not what you normally get for a grandfather, but we know that we share him with this country and with the world, and he always felt that he had a real personal connection with the American people. And so I think it's appropriate. I mean, and in this country, you know, to the extent that we ever have a single human being who represents the country, it's the president of the United States. And, you know, for better or for worse, that embodies our country for a period of time. And I think for many people in the country, he was a beacon of love and respect. And I think that's worth celebrating.
Was it his personal choice to tour all these important places posthumously?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you either have a state funeral or you don't. And so, you know, we as a family and he and my grandmother decided long ago that because of his time as a naval officer, his time as the president, he would sort of agree to have the state funeral. And when you do that, there's a series of events that have to be done. So he will be in the places that defined him in many ways. Plains, Georgia is where it begins. We'll come to Atlanta, to the Carter Center, and then to the U.S. Capitol and to Lyon State as the former president. And so I think those things are appropriate. And again, it may not be what you normally would have for your grandfather, but I think for him and his relationship with the American people, at least, he felt good about it.
That was Jason Carter, Jimmy's eldest grandson, talking to Paul Henley earlier. And as I was listening to that, I was watching pictures of Jason Carter beaming with pride as he addresses the packed congregation at the Carter Center as the private part of this funeral process begins. When Jimmy Carter ran a second time for governor, this time successfully in 1970, much of the state of Georgia was still instinctively segregationist. Democrats in rural Georgia, a southern state in the American Civil War 100 years before, still tended to be white and far from keen to embrace civil rights. Black Georgians in cities like Atlanta had more in common with Republican liberals in the North than they did with their own party Southerners. Angelo Fuster was a Democrat activist in the state capital at the time. He told me how views of gubernatorial candidate then Governor Jimmy Carter evolved in the late 60s and early 70s.
At that time, he could not afford as a white candidate for office to be perceived as a pro-black supporter. And so he was not negative about racial issues, but he was not aggressive. Mm. And at that time, what a candidate needed to be elected in Georgia was be white and also be usually conservative. So he played that role and did those games. But fortunately, he developed beyond that and had relationships with black elected officials that kind of surprised everybody.
The test, I suppose, is what he did once he was elected governor. How did he persuade people that he was sincere in his commitment to ending, or at least playing a big role in helping to end, racial division?
Well, he did go and reached out to the black community and reached out to some very important black political figures. There are a few, but there were some that crossed the line from black to white. And I had mentioned Maynard Jackson, who was the mayor of Atlanta for a number of terms, who was a man who was as liberal as they came and who became a spokesman for him.
And what are your thoughts as Georgia says goodbye to its most famous son, the one Georgian who has reached the presidency so far, and a man who wore his religion very openly, very sincerely? Was that an important part, do you think, of persuading many black Christians in Georgia?
I think so. I think that he came across as somebody who believed his faith and was always quite willing to discuss it. And so that gave, among the black community, gave them reassurance that this guy, I remember somebody called him Super Christian, this guy was somebody that they could support.
Do you think Georgians, regardless of their politics or indeed the color of their skin, are proud of Jimmy Carter?
Yes, very much so. And for a number of reasons, but his term in office was one of those, but his commitment to helping people across the world, in fact, for all these years, and his Christian beliefs really has been the element that made a huge difference for his political support in the state of Georgia.
Angelo Fuster there, a Democrat activist. Well, let's go live now to the Carter Center and Sarah Callis, politics reporter at Georgia Public Broadcasting. Sarah, thanks so much for talking to NewsHour. Tell us what's happening right now, if you will.
though, right now there is a service going on inside the Carter Center in Atlanta. Jason Carter, who's President Carter's grandson, has just been speaking, and then next we'll have a scripture reading from President Carter's personal pastor.
You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. Only goodness and faithful love will pursue me all the days of my life. And I will dwell in the house.
Tony London there was describing just a few moments ago while we were listening to Angela Fuster, Sarah, about how he used to visit Jimmy Carter, wrapped up in a blanket with the palms, with the Psalms on his lap open before him, right up really most weekends until he died last month. How would you describe the mood of Georgians? Because an awful lot of ordinary people have turned up on a Saturday morning to stand outside to watch the cortege as it approached the Carter Center.
So as was said earlier in the program, I think President Carter really started to transcend politics, especially in Georgia. He really was seen as Georgia's president more than a Democratic president. And people are definitely sad to see him go. I think there's a lot of people who feel that they have been personally touched by President Carter. But I mean, he was 100 years old, and I don't know that it was unexpected for anyone. But I am seeing some people are saddened just by a great man leaving Earth.
It's a splendid ceremonial, isn't it? I mean, you only have to look at the variety of uniforms represented to see, you know, those who would have protected him in office as president or those their modern equivalent. You see representatives of the National Guard, the state troopers, the people who would have been responsible to him when he was governor. And then, of course, many naval uniforms because he was at heart a naval man.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, as I said, a lot of people seem to have a personal connection with him. And there were members of all eight branches of the U.S. military were pallbearers to take President Carter's casket into the Carter Center.
And just briefly tell us in the last minute or so we have at this moment, what happens next after today's service? What's the rest of the period looking like between now and his funeral on Thursday?
So there will be a public repose service where members of the public can come pay tribute to President Carter through 6 a.m. on Tuesday here in Atlanta. And then after that, he will be transported via plane up to Washington, D.C., where he will lie in state at the U.S. Capitol. And there will be a funeral service at the National Cathedral. Then he will be transported back to his hometown of Plains, Georgia, which is in the southern part of the state, for the family funeral and his burial.
Sarah Callis, I know you'll continue watching the ceremonial there for Georgia Public Broadcasting. As politics reporter, I hope we'll get a chance to talk to you again before the end of this edition of NewsHour. Sarah there reporting live from the Carter Center on the beginning of the memorial service for the former US President Jimmy Carter, who died at the age of 100 last month. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming up on NewsHour, US President-elect Donald Trump's transition team is working on how to deliver his campaign promises, including the deportation of millions of migrants. Tess Feldman is an immigration attorney for the Los Angeles LGBT Center. She tells NewsHour there's still a backlog of cases outstanding for Mr. Trump's first term as president.
To hear that hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions more people, families, children would be processed through this system that is already operating with a 2-3-4 year lag, I am curious how this would be physically possible in this country.
Our headlines this hour. Coalition talks between Austria's two biggest centrist parties have collapsed. The Chancellor, Karl Nehammer, has said he'll resign. The coffin of former US President Jimmy Carter has arrived in the capital of his home state of Georgia, where it will remain until Tuesday for the public to pay their respects. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Darts has a new world champion this Saturday, and he's the youngest ever. 17-year-old Luke Littler lifted the trophy on Friday night, crowning a year in which he's injected a degree of youthful energy into a game traditionally seen as the preserve of beer-swilling middle-aged men. The BBC's Nick Robinson was at the Alexandra Palace in North London on Friday night where the final was taking place.
One double, and he becomes world champion. That is it. Luke Littler is not the only winner of this extraordinary night. Darts, a game condemned by many as a mere pub pastime, is suddenly turned into a global sporting phenomenon. Millions are watching, not just here, but around the world. Someone who knows that only too well is Emma Payton, who leads Sky's darts coverage.
In 2024, he picked up 10 titles, and some of the biggest ones as well, the likes of the Premier League, the likes of the Grand Slam. So look, for Luke Littler, being in back-to-back finals, this is only, it's only the start. Interest in the sport kind of skyrocketed because of Luke Littler last year, the fact that he was extremely relatable. This is a kid who had been playing darts since he was 18 months old. His dad went and bought a magnetic dartboard at a pound shop, and that is what really got him into the sport. And I think a lot of people started watching and saying, well, hold on a sec, if this kid can play, maybe I can have a go as well.
My name's Matt Porter. I'm the chief executive of the Professional Darts Corporation. It's traditionally been a British pub sport. It's traditionally been a game that's been played socially. But what you've seen over the last couple of decades is an explosion of the sport on a professional level.
And then this kid comes along and changes it again.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it? But it's actually the result of, or the, maybe it, not so much the result, but one rung on the ladder of the investment that we've had in junior darts for the last decade. And Luke Littler has been in that system since he was in nappies, pretty much. So, you know, what you've seen that he's produced over the last 12 months... maybe a surprise that he's reached the elite level of the sport so quickly, but it's not a surprise that he's come off that conveyor belt in such a way.
It's like any other sporty event. People are queuing up to go through security. Although it's not quite like any sporting event, because in front of me are two bananas, Superman, Mr. Impossible and Pikachu. You're dressed as...
Mexicans.
Mexican amigos.
Now, what brings you here?
My 18th birthday.
This is your birthday present.
Yeah,
congratulations.
Days, yeah. Thank
you. You're not that much younger than Luke Littler, are you?
No, only about a year or two.
So what has Luke Littler, doing as well as he does, done for you as a teenager?
Created so many more opportunities. There's been so many more like competition opportunities.
My name's Neil Bailey. I'm the CEO of Pitchside Hospitality.
Now, you might think that the darts is all about jugs of beer and fancy dress, but there is another side to it, isn't there?
Very much so. It's a huge hospitality, VIP, high-end offering at the moment. We've got Michelin star food.
Michelin star?
Yeah, we have Michelin star chefs in. We've had fine wines. We've got a cocktail station and champagne bar.
Cheeky question. How much would you pay to get in here?
Some of the guests here would have paid £1,000 a head, without being too rude. Yeah.
To come to the darts?
To come to the darts tonight. You've got a real diverse crowd. You know, you go into the main arena where everyone's dressed as Ali G, and you're as likely to bump into a corporate lawyer from the city as you are a scaffolder. It really is a real mixed bag at the darts, both in here and in the general admission seats.
It wasn't even close. The prince has beaten the king. If you've never watched the darts, if you've never heard of Luke Littler, you have now. He's not just changed his life, he's changed the way darts is seen. No longer a pub pastime, now a global money-making phenomenon.
That's Nick Robinson indulging himself, and who can blame him, at Alexandra Palace in London, at the final of the World Dance Championship. The president of Chile, Gabriel Boric, has become the first national leader in the Americas to set foot at the South Pole in Antarctica. His country has laid claim to at least part of the territory since the 1940s, but the visit has been prompted by concerns that the international treaty which protects the Antarctic for scientific research is in danger. Klaus Dodds is Professor of Geopolitics at Royal Holloway University of London. His research includes the international governance of the Antarctic. And earlier he told me why President Boric was there.
President Boric is actually from the far south of Chile, Punta Arenas, and he's really passionate about Chile being understood as an Antarctic nation. And really, since the 1940s, Chile has maintained an important claim to what it calls the Chilean Antarctic Territory. So the timing is also significant beyond this historic claim, because there's really quite a bit of concern about what's going on in Antarctica at the moment.
And what is that concern, and who is it focused on?
So I think there are two aspects. One is that President Milei in Argentina has been showing a sort of increasing interest in Argentina's historic claim to the Antarctic, and visited the far south, the city of Ushuaia, to talk about possible collaboration with the United States. And that will always unsettle any Chilean president in terms of what the near neighbor's getting up to. Mm. But the real concern is actually what China and Russia are doing in the Antarctic and the growing interest they're taking in the resource value of the continent.
And they have slightly different focuses, don't they, the two countries?
Yes. I mean, China very much is into fishing, both fish and what's called krill. And Russia is just generally a more disruptive actor that is very eager to investigate where it can possible oil and gas potential.
Now, we've talked a lot on the World Service in the recent past about the tensions being caused in the Arctic Circle because the sea ice is breaking up. Suddenly people can see not only potential new navigation routes, but also access to resources that are underwater. Is it a similar issue in the Antarctic?
Well, the Antarctic is complicated by the fact that we have an Antarctic Treaty, and it's really important to stress that the treaty, which Russia and China are signatories to, says that all forms of mining are prohibited. So what we're talking about is Russia taking a speculative interest in the hydrocarbon potential of the continent. And there's just a worry that what's happening is that both China and Russia are preparing the ground for a time when the treaty, if it did collapse, then it might lead to a view of the Antarctic, not as a protected wilderness, but as a kind of strategic resource frontier.
And that could open up all sorts of other related consequences, presumably not least the worry of kind of military buildup.
Exactly, because the Antarctic Treaty also says utterly clearly that the Antarctic should remain demilitarized and denuclearized. It's very much a Cold War treaty, and that's why the focus is on that particular element. But yes, there is this sort of a growing concern that if the treaty fragments, and what's going to happen is China is just going to fish the Southern Ocean to its heart's content in the name of food security. Russia is going to look at things like oil and gas potential. And the real worry is that smaller countries, by the way, including the United Kingdom, are just going to get elbowed out the way as it becomes a site of great power rivalry.
Professor Klaus Dodds at Royal Holloway University in London on the threat to the international governance of the Antarctic.
Delve into a world of secrets. The BBC's Global Investigations podcast, breaking major news stories around the world.
A BBC investigation finds that Mohamed Al-Fayed, former owner of Harrods, was accused of raping five members of staff.
Mohamed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
From the top of British society to the heart of global fashion brands.
The former boss of clothing brand Abercrombie and Fitch is accused of exploiting young men for sex.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
Gripping investigations, available to listen to now, with more coming soon. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts and click follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.
Welcome back to NewsHour. The US Surgeon General says alcoholic drinks should carry warnings about the risks of cancer. Vivek Murthy, who will leave office when President Biden does so later this month, says alcohol is the most common preventable cause of cancer after tobacco and obesity. The Surgeon General estimates it's responsible for 20,000 deaths each year in the United States. At present, alcoholic drinks only carry warnings against drinking during pregnancy or while operating machinery or driving. However, changing the labels would require legislation by the US Congress. Well, I asked Professor Pat Price, an oncologist at Imperial College London, whether the Surgeon General's advice should be listened to elsewhere in the world.
As a doctor, we'd absolutely have to support it. The evidence about the relationship between alcohol and cancer is very clear. We've accepted it in smoking, so it's about time we probably did in alcohol. I appreciate that there'll be some against it and that type of thing, but I think we have to support accurate public health information.
Why do you think it's something we haven't focused on? Because it's not as if we've ignored the risks that come from alcohol when we talk about things like cirrhosis of the liver.
I think that's right. And I think probably because we're getting that message over of cirrhosis of the liver and that type of an alcohol dependency. But this has been clear. Cancer Research UK in England here did a survey a few years ago. 9 out of 10 people were unaware of the link with cancer. In the UK, 1 in 10 breast cancers is thought to be alcohol related. That's a lot. That's a significant risk. And people need to have this information.
It's a bit frustrating, I suppose, that this is being said in the dying days of the administration, although perhaps one cause for optimism for campaigners like you is that the incoming president, Donald Trump, is famously teetotal.
Yes. And I think there will be a push, really, for some changes, which is good. And also, it may be thinking about the economic benefit, because alcohol-related disease and also alcohol-related cancer cost billions in healthcare. So it is in everybody's benefit to actually cut down this and have a healthy nation. We all know the connection now between health and wealth. So let's do something about this.
Alcohol is simply carcinogenic, or is there more to it than that? Why, in other words, is seen as a trigger for particular kinds of cancer?
Yes, you're right. And there are very clear mechanisms. One of the mechanisms is that when it's metabolized, we know that it's metabolized in the liver, but also in things like breast tissue. And the product of that is actually causes cancer. We know also it changes how you absorb things in the mouth and throat, which is why you get cancers there. And also our second greatest problem is obesity. Mm. And obviously more alcohol, more obesity. So you've got a double whammy there. And I think we all get it that we shouldn't be so obese.
That's the British oncologist Professor Pat Price on the risk from alcohol consumption of developing cancer. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Sean Lay. To Syria now, where the Kurdish authorities run parts of northern Syria have joined condemnation of changes to the country's school curriculum. Reports last week suggested Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, the rebel group which caused the Assad regime to collapse last month, was planning to remove the theory of evolution and the Ottoman Empire from classroom teaching. On a visit on Friday to meet Ahmed al-Sharaa, the country's interim leader, the German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock urged him not to Islamise the judicial or the education systems. According to the Syrian Kurdish news agency, the Kurdish-run education authority said the proposed change would weaken the unity of Syrians and create the danger of raising an extremist generation. Well, Syria's new leaders are pressing both the United States and the EU to lift sanctions. Tobias Lindner, the German Foreign Office's special coordinator for Syria, says the Europeans have conditions, including how inclusive the new school curriculum becomes.
We expect that a transitional phase, also the phase how a constitution is being drafted, needs to be as inclusive as possible. So it needs to include all the Syrians, be it Kurds, be it Alawites, be it Druzes, Christians, you name it. And so it needs to include all religions, all ethnicities, and it needs to respect fundamental human rights, especially women's and girls' rights.
Well, I've been speaking to Haith Sheikh Ibrahim, Professor of English Literature at Idlib University in a province which has been run by HTS for some years. He defended what they're trying to do nationally.
Actually, you know that the curriculum is full with fake things, like, for example, statements glorifying the last president, Bashar Assad. So it's, you know, how can you say that this is a revolution? And at the same time, our children are still reading about, you know, the fake glory and the fake victory that Bashar Assad did.
People may understand what you're saying about the things that children were taught about the Assads, but they wouldn't necessarily see the teachings of Charles Darwin about evolution as also fake and needing to be removed. And yet we are told that is one of the things that the Minister of Education intends to take out of the curriculum as well.
As I told you, the curriculum contains a lot of things that do not go in line with the revolution. Statements glorifying the last regime. This is number one. Sometimes we have, unsuitable information for the age of the era. For example, teaching school boys about Darwin's evolution, about Darwin's theories, that we think that it's not appropriate now to teach them about their things. Although we teach these theories at our universities, we do teach these theories at our universities and even all the philosophical things which deny the existence of God. We don't have any problem when we have, amateur, adult learner. Okay. But actually to teach, things like which are controversial. Even Darwin's theories are controversial, So we don't like now to get our learner into such controversial things from his early learning stages.
You support removing the theory of evolution from the school curriculum. Let me put a point to you on that. You say that students will learn it at university and will be able to discuss it freely, but most Syrians don't go to university. They do go to school. Therefore, aren't you denying them an area of knowledge for reasons of ideology?
Actually, yes, I do agree, because they are not that important. These changes are not that important.
They are important to some of the countries who you need to lift sanctions. We had the German special representative to Syria, Mr. Lindner, told the BBC today that they do not want to see those kinds of changes to the curriculum, and that could have an effect on whether the Europeans are willing to lift sanctions that are currently imposed against Syria. Your government needs those sanctions lifted.
So you mean that our government needs to be flexible?
Yes, I think that's what the Europeans are asking for.
So actually, I can assure you that the government is really flexible. But actually, when we see that, ministries of foreign affairs talking about these things, actually, sometimes now, I don't think that this is appropriate.
Can I ask you a more general point? And it's nothing to do with Europeans, and it's everything to do with Syrians. Do you accept that Syria is such a diverse country that what may seem acceptable to you in Idlib may not seem acceptable to other Syrians in, say, Latakia? And that, therefore, you can't have one imposed curriculum. It has to be developed together with all parts of the community working on it.
This is a good question. That before the fighters here were able to defeat the regime and take the country, next day and the other days, a huge number of people took the streets and started to greet the newcomers. I'm not talking about, tens of thousands of people. I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of people and millions of people who started to receive the newcomers because they are happy for the change. So this gives you a clear picture about what was taking place in Idlib. So the other side, the people living under the regime's control in the past, already knew what was going on here in Idlib. So we succeeded in administrating Idlib and the countryside of Idlib in a good way. Actually, we had banks, we had universities, we have schools. Mm-hmm. Although we used to receive bombs every day, while the regime's area suffered a lot. So already they knew what was taking place in Idlib. So when we were able to arrive Damascus, the people started to receive us with flowers.
Yeah.
Why? Because they longed and they wanted the change. And this is exactly what happened.
That's Professor Haith Sheikh Ibrahim on why the school curriculum changes are needed. Now, ever since President Assad gave up power and fled the country last month, it's not been easy to speak to people who were members of the Syrian government at the time. But we managed today to get hold of one of them, President Assad's last Minister of Education, Professor Mohammed Amir Mardini. First, what does he make of the changes in the curriculum? And I should say that Professor Mardini gave me his responses in Arabic, which the BBC has translated.
This is correct because it's related to the ideology or ideologization of the curriculum, which is not accepted in education because it was related to the propaganda of the regime. And this is not accepted. And they do it through two institutions. These institutions are Munazzam al-Tala'i al-Ba'ath, which is basically the organization of the front guard of the Ba'ath party, and the Munazzam al-Shabibat al-Thawra, and the organization of the youth of the revolution.
Are you concerned, though, that some of the changes may be designed to act as a way of encouraging the young people of Syria to be more Islamist in their outlook?
In general, my opinion is that ideology is not good in education, regardless of what ideology it is. The youth should be taught sciences, good, bad, justice, kindness, conventions, traditions, behavior, and all the good things. And I would repeat my position concisely and briefly. I am against the ideology in education, any ideology.
Can I ask you one specific? And this is an example that I discussed with a professor of English at Idlib University, Professor Haith Sheikh Ibrahim, and that is the changes to the teaching of evolution. He said it's not appropriate for school children to learn about Charles Darwin's theory of evolution and that that should be confined to university undergraduates only. What is your view of that?
In fact, in the Ministry of Education, we have people who are specialized in the development of the curricula, and they are scientific experts and education guides or directors who are specialists. Sometimes they agree, sometimes they disagree in topics, but there's a basic principle that we rely on, which is it must be evidence-based, be it evolution or other thing, be it the evolution of the brain or the evolution of anything. So if it is an evidence-based topic in Syria, in the US, in the UK, in Zimbabwe, in South Africa, equally everywhere as an evidence-based science, yes, it must be used and adopted because it's a scientific principle. But if it's ideology, no. And if it's science-based, it should be adopted regardless of it being against or with ideology.
Would you like to see the changes to the curriculum discussed and debated by different parts and different communities in Syria before they are made permanent?
I mentioned a very important point, which is the Center for the Development of the Curricula that we have in the ministry. And in the center, there are experts, as I said. And I think that if we have in the center experts from different sects and different segments and parts of our community and society who are scientifically able to do the job, they will be the ones who will agree and disagree about these things. And then if they agree on it and that it is scientifically proven and that it's based on scientific principles, then we will adopt it and it will be used.
Let me ask you a little bit, if I may, about the end of the regime of President Assad. How difficult were those last few days in Damascus with the rebels approaching the city and with the government apparently collapsing around you?
There's an important point, in fact, which is the people have got rid of the regime that have remained there for a long time, oppressing the Syrian people in a manner that's not satisfactory to anyone. People are joyful and euphoric about it because this regime remained for about 60 years. People are very happy at this stage, and they are particularly happy because it was done with no bloodshed. It passed easily, and people are comfortable to things as they are now.
Professor Mardini, do you have any regrets about your time as Minister, either of Higher Education or as Minister of Education?
In fact, I did my job as a technocrat. I worked according to my conscience and to meet the needs of my homeland. All the decisions I've made in the interest of the student, be it at the higher education level or the school levels, be it the primary schools or the secondary schools. And the decisions I've made in the interest of safeguarding the Syrian certificates in all levels of education. Therefore, I have not had any regrets, despite all the pressures that have been exercised on me to neutralize my important decisions. And I repeat that I worked based on my conscience. And therefore, thanks God, I am very satisfied with my performance there.
That's the former Minister of Education in Syria, Professor Mohamed Amir Mardini, talking to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. US President-elect Donald Trump's transition team is working on how to deliver his campaign promises, including the deportation of millions of migrants. Many in California are urgently trying to get their paperwork in order, fearing a knock on the door from the Immigration Service. But those in charge of what calls itself the Golden State say they're determined to oppose Mr. Trump's plan. From Los Angeles, the BBC's Regan Morris reports.
Good morning. Buenos días, familia. ¿Cómo están?
Immigrants packed into a public school in Los Angeles to get free legal advice. Workshops to help immigrants get their papers in order have been held across California since Donald Trump was elected in November. Many here say they are afraid of being deported.
I am feeling anxious about what is going to happen in the next 4 years. I'm worried of my safety.
Andrea is 33 and came to the U.S. from Mexico as a child. Like everyone else at this workshop, she didn't want her full name used to protect her identity.
I want one day for my kids to come home, and I'm not home because I was deported. So, yeah, it's just because I'm worried, and I have a family here. I pay my taxes. I'm a teacher as well.
Like many people in California, some members of Andrea's own family supported Donald Trump for president, including her mother, who herself is vulnerable to deportation. Although unable to vote, Andrea's mother urged others to support Trump because she believes he will be better for the economy and that he will only deport criminal immigrants. Since the election, Californians have come out demonstrating in support of immigrant rights, and the state has vowed to defend its immigrant population. California sued the Trump administration more than 120 times last time Donald Trump was president. And California Governor Newsom convened a special session of the legislature to prepare for possible future lawsuits.
As it relates to the special session, that's a special session to focus on litigation, preparation, as it relates to the reality. It's not a theoretical exercise. We know what happened the last time Donald Trump was president.
Although Donald Trump lost California, as was expected, he did better here this election than 4 years ago, with 38% of the Golden State's vote. And he won the presidency with the promise of deporting millions of people.
I will rescue every city and town that has been invaded and conquered. I will launch the largest deportation program in American history.
Critics say he will struggle to keep his promises. Immigration attorneys say the system is so backlogged that they don't see how anyone could deport so many people. Tess Feldman is an immigration attorney for the Los Angeles LGBT Center. She says many of her clients seeking asylum had their cases started under the first Trump administration.
When I appear before a judge, I often request the first available court date for my client to be heard on their case.
Did you want to take any of this?
And oftentimes that's a 2 or 3 year scheduling wait. So to hear that hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions more people, families, children would be processed through this system that is already operating with a 2, 3, 4 year lag, I am curious how this would be physically possible in this country.
Many are curious how that will work. But critics say any attempt to Trump-proof California is premature and that people should focus on the facts, not the rhetoric. Although the Biden administration was blamed for letting the border get out of control, the fact is his administration deported more immigrants in 2024 than Donald Trump ever did, more than 270,000 people. That was the highest tally of deportations since Obama was in office 10 years ago.
The BBC's Regan Morris reporting from Los Angeles. Let's return briefly to our top story, the state funeral of President Jimmy Carter. The tone at the end of the service, which has just concluded, had something of the feel of a revivalist meeting, perhaps appropriate for a man who described himself as born again. Sarah Callis, politics reporter at Georgia Public Broadcasting, is at the Carter Center in Atlanta, where that service has been taking place. And Sarah, the lying in repose begins tomorrow, which is an opportunity for those who feel so disposed to come and pay their own private respects to the former president.
Yes, absolutely. And the Carter Center is saying that they're expecting thousands of people every hour to come pay their respects to President Carter.
It's extraordinary in some ways, isn't it? Because he was a pretty divisive figure when he was in office, and many regarded his presidency as a failure.
Mm-hmm. He definitely was controversial while he was in office, but I think his humanitarian work once he left the White House is really what he will be remembered by. And I mean, he is the only president from the state of Georgia, and I think all Georgians feel a sense of pride with Carter, regardless of their political party.
Yeah, he won the Nobel Prize at one point, didn't he? Which I'm sure many presidents and former presidents alike would like to be able to have on their memorial. But he seemed to win it in part because of his extraordinary ability to go to really quite dangerous places and to promote the values that he believed in, not least of multi-party democracy, regardless of what that party was.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, his humanitarian work with the Carter Center and their Democracy Watch program is definitely something that will be remembered by many from around the world. And Jason Carter, the grandson and the chair of the Carter Center, spoke during the service today about his grandfather's legacy and how he feels like his spirit lives on through the employees of the Carter Center.
Sarah Callis from Georgia Public Broadcasting. Thank you so much. Live there at the Carter Center in Atlanta. I have a small anecdote which was told to me by a British politician many years ago who said he hoped it would be heard when President Carter died. He was on an election mission to protect the integrity of voting in a Latin American country, and they were at a polling station where they watched a very large man with a gun in a uniform pick up a ballot box stuffed full of ballot papers, the votes of ordinary people in that country's election, and watched him start to walk out of the polling station. Whereupon Jimmy Carter, with no thought to his own safety, walked up to the man, stood in front of him, looked up at him, because Carter was a relatively small man, looked up at this towering figure and said, "Put that back." And this politician said to me there was a pause, rather like in the film High Noon. And then the man in the uniform with the gun meekly turned round, walked back, returned the ballot box to where it belonged, and walked out of the polling station. And that politician, who was no fan of Jimmy Carter and certainly didn't share his politics, said that experience completely transformed his view of the retired president of the United States and enormously cemented his respect for Jimmy Carter. You've been listening to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for your company, and we'll leave you with sounds from the memorial service from former US President Jimmy Carter.
For just as long as Hollywood has been Tinseltown, there have been suspicions about what lurks behind the glitz and glamour.
Concerns about radical propaganda in the motion pictures.
And for a while, those suspicions grew into something much bigger and much darker.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm Una Chaplin, and this is Hollywood Exiles. It's about a battle for the political soul of America. And the battlefield was Hollywood.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.